Big Graves then rescinded the offer because he had no healthy guards to watch them. With no gravediggers, bodies could not be buried. Undertakers' work areas were overflowing. They stacked caskets in halls, in their living quarters. Many lived above their businesses. Then undertakers ran short of coffins. The few coffins available suddenly became priceless. Michael Donahue's family operated a funeral home. We had caskets stacked up outside the funeral home. We had to have guards kept on them because people were stealing the caskets. You'd equate that to grave robbing. There were soon no caskets left to steal. Louise Apachase remembered most vividly the lack of coffins. A neighbor boy about 7 or 8 died, and they used to just pick you up and wrap you up in a sheet and put you in a patrol wagon. So the mother and father, screaming, "Let me get a macaroni box for a coffin." Macaroni, any kind of pasta, used to come in this box. About 20 pounds of macaroni fit in it. "Please, please let me put him in the macaroni box. Don't take him away like that." Clifford Adams remembered bodies stacked up. Stacked up out to be buried. They couldn't bury them. The bodies backed up more and more. Backed up in the houses, were put outside on porches. The city morgue had room for 36 bodies. 200 were stacked there. The stench was terrible. Doors and windows were thrown open. No more bodies could fit. Bodies lay in homes where they died, as they died, often with bloody liquid seeping from the nostrils or mouths. Families covered the bodies in ice. Even so, the bodies began to putrefy and stink. Tenements had no porches. Few had fire escapes. Families closed off rooms where a body lay, but a closed door could not close out the knowledge and the horror of what lay behind the door. In much of the city, a city more short of housing than New York, people had no room that could be closed off. Corpses were wrapped in sheets, pushed into corners, left there sometimes for days, the horror of it sinking in deeper each hour. People too sick to cook for themselves, too sick to clean themselves, too sick to move the corpse off the bed, lying alive on the same bed with the corpse. The dead lay there for days, while the living lived with them, were horrified by them, and, perhaps most horribly, became accustomed to them. Symptoms were terrifying. Blood poured from noses, ears, eye sockets. Some victims lay in agony. Delirium took others away while living. Routinely, 2 people in a single family would die. 3 deaths in a family were not uncommon. Sometimes a family suffered even more. David Sword lived at 2802 Jackson Street. On October 5th, the 6th member of his family died of influenza, while the North American reported that 3 other family members in the hospital may also die of the plague. The plague. In the streets, people had been whispering the word. The word slipped somehow, once by accident, into that newspaper. The morale issue, the self-censorship, the intent by editors to put every piece of news in the most positive possible context, all meant that no newspaper used that word again. Yet people did not need newspapers to speak of the Black Death. Some bodies were turning almost black. People had seen them, and they had lost faith in what they read anyway. One young medical student called in to treat hundreds of patients recalled, "The cyanosis reached an intensity that I have never seen since." Indeed, the rumor got about that the Black Death had returned. The newspapers quoted Dr. Raymond Leopold, sounding reasonable. "There is abundant reason for such a rumor. It is true that many bodies have assumed a dark hue and have given off a pronounced odor after death." But he gave his assurance, "There is no truth in the Black Plague assertion." He was, of course, correct. But how many trusted the newspapers anymore? And even if the Black Death had not come, a plague had, and, with it, so had terror. The war had come home. Long before Hagedorn's suicide, long before the marchers in Philadelphia began to parade down the city streets, influenza had seeded itself along the edges of the nation. On September 4th, it had reached New Orleans, with the three seamen, who soon died, carried to the hospital off the Harold Walker from Boston. On September 7th, it had reached the Great Lakes Naval Training Station, with sailors transferred from Boston. In the next few days, ports and naval facilities on the Atlantic and Gulf coasts, in Newport, New London, Norfolk, Mobile, and Biloxi, also reported this new influenza. On September 17, 1918, the extensive prevalence of an influenza-like disease was reported in Petersburg, Virginia, outside Camp Lee. That same day, the several hundred sailors who had departed Philadelphia earlier for Puget Sound arrived. 11 men had to be carried from the ship on stretchers to a hospital, bringing the new virus to the Pacific. The virus had spanned the country, establishing itself on the Atlantic, in the Gulf, on the Pacific, on the Great Lakes. It had not immediately erupted in epidemic form, but it had seeded itself. Then the seeds began to sprout into flowers of flame. The virus followed rail and river into the interior of the continent, from New Orleans up the Mississippi River into the body of the nation, from Seattle to the east, from the Great Lakes training station to Chicago, and from there along the railroad lines in many directions. From each original locus, fingers reached out unevenly, like sparks shooting out, often jumping over closer points to farther ones. From Boston to Newport, for example, and only then reaching backward to fill in Brockton and Providence and places in between. On September 28th, when the Liberty Loan paraders marched through Philadelphia streets, there were as yet only 7 cases reported in Los Angeles, 2 in San Francisco. But the virus would get there soon enough. In Philadelphia, meanwhile, fear came and stayed. Death could come from anyone, anytime. People moved away from others on the sidewalk, avoided conversation. If they did speak, they turned their faces away to avoid the other person's breathing. People became isolated, increasing the fear. The impossibility of getting help compounded the isolation. 850 Philadelphia doctors and more nurses were away in the military. More than that number were sick. Philadelphia General Hospital had 126 nurses. Despite all precautions, despite wearing surgical masks and gowns, 8 doctors and 54 nurses, 43% of the staff, themselves required hospitalization. 10 nurses at this single hospital died. The Board of Health pleaded for help from retired nurses and doctors if they remembered even a little of their profession. When a nurse or doctor or policeman did actually come, they wore their ghostly surgical masks, and people fled them. In every home where someone was ill, people wondered if the person would die. And someone was ill in every home. Philadelphia had 5 medical schools. Each one dismissed its classes, and 3rd and 4th year students manned emergency hospitals being set up in schools and empty buildings all over the city. The Philadelphia College of Pharmacy closed as well, sending its students out to help druggists. Before University of Pennsylvania medical students went out to man the hospitals, they listened to a lecture from Alfred Stengel, the expert on infectious diseases who had treated the crew of the City of Exeter what seemed so long ago. Stengel reviewed dozens of ideas that had been advanced in medical journals. Gargles of various disinfectants, drugs, immune sera, typhoid vaccine, diphtheria antitoxin. But Stengel's message was simple. This doesn't work. That doesn't work. Nothing worked. His suggestion for treatment was negative, Isaac Starr, one of those Penn students who became an internationally known cardiologist, recalled. He had no confidence in any of the remedies that had been proposed. Stengel was correct. Nothing they were yet doing worked. Starr went to emergency hospital number 2 at 18th and Cherry Streets. He did have help, if it could be called that, from an elderly physician who had not practiced in years and who brought Starr into touch with the worst of heroic medicine. Starr wouldn't forget that. The ancient arts of purging, of venesection, the ancient art of opening a patient's vein. But for the most part, he and the other students elsewhere were on their own, with little help even from nurses, who were so desperately needed that in each of 10 emergency hospitals supplied by the Red Cross, only a single qualified nurse was available to oversee whatever women came as volunteers. And often, the volunteers reported for their duty once and, from either fear or exhaustion, did not come again. Starr had charge of an entire floor of an emergency hospital. He thought at first his patients had what appeared to be a minor illness, with fever but little else. Unhappily, the clinical features of many soon changed. Most striking again was the cyanosis, his patients sometimes turning almost black. After gasping for several hours, they became delirious and incontinent, and many died struggling to clear their airways of a blood-tinged froth that sometimes gushed from their nose and mouth. Nearly one quarter of all the patients in his hospital died each day. Starr would go home, and when he returned the next day, he would find that between one quarter and one fifth of the patients in the hospital had died, replaced by new ones. Literally hundreds of thousands of people in Philadelphia were falling ill. Virtually all of them, along with their friends and relatives, were terrified that, no matter how mild the symptoms seemed at first, within them moved an alien force. A seething, spreading infection. A live thing with a will that was taking over their bodies and could be killing them. And those who moved about them feared. Feared both for the victims and for themselves. The city was frozen with fear, frozen quite literally into stillness. Starr lived 12 miles from the hospital in Chestnut Hill. The streets were silent on his drive home. Silent. They were so silent he took to counting the cars he saw. One night, he saw no cars at all. He thought, the life of the city had almost stopped. Part 6. The Pestilence. Chapter 20. This was influenza. Only influenza. This new influenza virus, like most new influenza viruses, spread rapidly and widely. As a modern epidemiologist already quoted has observed, influenza is a special instance among infectious diseases. This virus is transmitted so effectively that it exhausts the supply of susceptible hosts. This meant that the virus sickened tens of millions of people in the United States. In many cities, more than half of all families had at least one victim ill with influenza. In San Antonio, the virus made more than half the entire population ill, and hundreds of millions across the world. But this was influenza. Only influenza. The overwhelming majority of victims got well. They endured, sometimes a mild attack and sometimes a severe one, and they recovered. The virus passed through this vast majority in the same way influenza viruses usually did. Victims had an extremely unpleasant several days. The unpleasantness multiplied by terror that they would develop serious complications, and then recovered within 10 days. The course of the disease in these millions actually convinced the medical profession that this was indeed only influenza. But in a minority of cases, and not just in a tiny minority, the virus manifested itself in an influenza that did not follow normal patterns, that was unlike any influenza ever reported, that followed a course so different from the usual one for the disease that Welch himself had initially feared some new kind of infection or plague. If Welch feared it, those who suffered with the disease were terrified by it. Generally, in the Western world, the virus demonstrated extreme virulence or led to pneumonia in from 10 to 20% of all cases. In the United States, this translated into 2 to 3 million cases. In other parts of the world, chiefly in isolated areas where people had rarely been exposed to influenza viruses, in Eskimo settlements of Alaska, in jungle villages of Africa, in islands of the Pacific, the virus demonstrated extreme virulence in far more than 20% of cases. These numbers most likely translate into several hundred million severe cases around the world, in a world with a population less than one-third that of today. This was still influenza. Only influenza. The most common symptoms then as now are well known. The mucosal membranes in the nose, pharynx, and throat become inflamed. The conjunctiva, the delicate membrane that lines the eyelids, becomes inflamed. Victims suffer headache, body aches, fever, often complete exhaustion, cough. As one leading clinician observed in 1918, the disease was ushered in by two groups of symptoms. In the first place, the constitutional reactions of an acute febrile disease: headache, general aching, chills, fever, malaise, prostration, anorexia, nausea, or vomiting. And in the second place, symptoms referable to an intense congestion of the mucous membranes of the nose, pharynx, larynx, trachea, and upper respiratory tract in general, and of the conjunctivae. Another noted, the disease began with absolute exhaustion and chill, fever, headache, conjunctivitis, pain in back and limbs, flushing of face. Cough was often constant. Upper air passages were clogged. A third reported, in non-fatal cases, the temperature ranged from 100 to 103 degrees Fahrenheit. Non-fatal cases usually recovered after an illness of about a week. Then there were the cases in which the virus struck with violence. To those who suffered a violent attack, there was often pain, terrific pain, and the pain could come almost anywhere. The disease also separated them, pushed them into a solitary and concentrated place. In Philadelphia, Clifford Adams said, "I didn't think about anything. I got to the point where I didn't care if I died or not. I just felt like that all my life was nothing but when I breathe." Bill Sardo in Washington, D.C. recalled, "I wasn't expected to live, just like everybody else that had gotten it. You were sick as a dog, and you weren't in a coma, but you were in a condition that at the height of the crisis you weren't thinking normally, and you weren't reacting normally. You sort of had delusions." In Lincoln, Illinois, William Maxwell felt, "Time was a blur as I was lying in that little upstairs room, and I had no sense of day or night. I felt sick and hollow inside, and I knew from telephone calls my aunt had, I knew enough to be alarmed about my mother. I heard her say, 'Will, oh no,' and then, 'If you want me to.' The tears ran down her face, so she didn't need to tell me." Josie Brown fell ill working as a nurse at the Great Lakes Naval Training Station, and her heart was racing so hard and pounding that it was going to jump out of her chest, and with terrible fevers, she was shaking so badly that the ice would rattle and would shake the chart attached to the end of the bed. Harvey Cushing, Halstead's protege, who had already attained prominence himself but had yet to make his full reputation, served in France. On October 8, 1918, he wrote in his journal, "Something has happened to my hind legs, and I wobble like a Tibetic. Someone suffering from a long and wasting illness, like a person with AIDS who needs a cane, and can't feel the floor when I unsteadily get up in the morning." So this is the sequence of the grip. We may perhaps thank it for helping us win the war if it really hit the German army thus hard during their offensive. In his case, what seemed to be the complications were largely neurological. On October 31st, after spending 3 weeks in bed with headache, double vision, and numbness of both legs, he observed, "It's a curious business, unquestionably still progressing, with considerable muscular wasting. I have a vague sense of familiarity with the sensation, as if I had met it somewhere in a dream." 4 days later, "My hands now have caught up with my feet, so numb and clumsy that shaving's a danger and buttoning laborious. When the periphery is thus affected, the brain too is benumbed and awkward. Cushing would never fully recover." And across the lines lay Rudolf Binding, a German officer, who described his illness as something like typhoid, with ghastly symptoms of intestinal poisoning. "For weeks, he was in the grip of the fever. Some days I am quite free. Then again a weakness overcomes me, so that I can barely drag myself in a cold perspiration onto my bed and blankets. Then pain, so that I don't care whether I am alive or dead." Catherine Ann Porter was a reporter then, on the Rocky Mountain News. Her fiancé, a young officer, died. He caught the disease nursing her, and she too was expected to die. Her colleagues set her obituary in type. She lived. In Pale Horse, Pale Rider, she described her movement toward death. "She lay on a narrow ledge over a pit she knew to be bottomless, and soft, carefully shaped words like oblivion and eternity are curtains hung before nothing at all. Her mind tottered and slithered again, broke from its foundation and spun like a cast wheel in a ditch. She sank easily through deeps and deeps of darkness until she lay like a stone at the farthest bottom of life, knowing herself to be blind, deaf, speechless, no longer aware of the members of her own body, entirely withdrawn from all human concerns, yet alive with a peculiar lucidity and coherence. All notions of the mind, all ties of blood and the desires of the heart dissolved and fell away from her, and there remained of her only a minute, fiercely burning particle of being that knew itself alone, that relied upon nothing beyond itself for its strength, not susceptible to any appeal or inducement, being itself composed entirely of one single motive, the stubborn will to live. This fiery, motionless particle set itself unaided to resist destruction, to survive and to be in its own madness of being, motiveless and planless beyond that one essential end. Then, as she climbed back from that depth, pain returned, a terrible, compelling pain running through her veins like heavy fire. The stench of corruption filled her nostrils, the sweetish, sickening smell of rotting flesh and pus. She opened her eyes and saw pale light through a coarse white cloth over her face, knew that the smell of death was in her own body, and struggled to lift her hand. These victims came with an extraordinary array of symptoms, symptoms either previously unknown entirely in influenza or experienced with previously unknown intensity. Initially, physicians, good physicians, intelligent physicians searching for a disease that fitted the clues before them, and influenza did not fit the clues, routinely misdiagnosed the disease. Patients would writhe from agonizing pain in their joints. Doctors would diagnose dengue, also called breakbone fever. Patients would suffer extreme fever and chills, shuddering, shivering, then huddling under blankets. Doctors would diagnose malaria. Dr. Henry Berg at New York City's Willard Parker Hospital, across the street from William Parks Hospital, worried that the patient's complaints of a burning pain above the diaphragm meant cholera. Noted another doctor, many had vomiting. Some became tender over the abdomen, indicating an intra-abdominal condition. In Paris, While some physicians also diagnosed cholera or dysentery, others interpreted the intensity and location of headache pain as typhoid. Deep into the epidemic, Parisian physicians still remained reluctant to diagnose influenza. In Spain, public health officials also declared that the complications were due to typhoid, which was general throughout Spain. But neither typhoid nor cholera, neither dengue nor yellow fever, neither plague nor tuberculosis, neither diphtheria nor dysentery could account for other symptoms. No known disease could. In Proceedings of the Royal Society of Medicine, a British physician noted one thing I have never seen before, namely the occurrence of subcutaneous emphysema, pockets of air accumulating just beneath the skin, beginning in the neck and spreading sometimes over the whole body. Those pockets of air leaking through ruptured lungs made patients crackle when they were rolled onto their sides. One Navy nurse later compared the sound to a bowl of Rice Krispies, and the memory of that sound was so vivid to her that for the rest of her life she could not tolerate being around anyone who was eating Rice Krispies. Extreme earaches were common. One physician observed that otitis media, inflammation of the middle ear marked by pain, fever, and dizziness, developed with surprising rapidity, and rupture of the drum membrane was observed at times in a few hours after the onset of pain. Another wrote, "Otitis media reported in 41 cases. Otologists on duty day and night and did immediate paracentesis, insertion of a needle to remove fluid, on all bulging eardrums." Another, "Discharge of pus from the external ear was noted. At autopsy, practically every case showed otitis media with perforation. This destructive action on the drum seems to me to be similar to the destructive action on the tissues of the lung." The headaches throbbed deep in the skull, victims feeling as if their heads would literally split open, as if a sledgehammer were driving a wedge not into the head, but from inside the head out. The pain seemed to locate particularly behind the eye orbit and could be nearly unbearable when patients moved their eyes. There were areas of lost vision, areas where the normal frame of sight went black. Some paralysis of ocular muscles was frequently recorded, and German medical literature noted eye involvement with special frequency, sometimes in 25% of influenza cases. The ability to smell was affected, sometimes for weeks. Rarer complications included acute, even fatal, renal failure. Reye's syndrome attacked the liver. An army summary later stated simply, the symptoms were of exceeding variety as to severity and kind. It was not only death, but these symptoms that spread the terror. This was influenza. Only influenza. Yet to a layperson at home, to a wife caring for a husband, to a father caring for a child, to a brother caring for a sister, symptoms unlike anything they had seen terrified. And the symptoms terrified a Boy Scout delivering food to an incapacitated family. They terrified a policeman who entered an apartment to find a tenant dead or dying. They terrified a man who volunteered his car as an ambulance. The symptoms chilled laypeople, chilled them with winds of fear. The world looked black. Cyanosis turned it black. Patients might have few other symptoms at first, but if nurses and doctors noted cyanosis, they began to treat such patients as terminal, as the walking dead. If the cyanosis became extreme, death was certain. And cyanosis was common. One physician reported, intense cyanosis was a striking phenomenon. The lips, ears, nose, cheeks, tongue, conjunctivae, fingers, and sometimes the entire body partook of a dusky, leaden hue. And another, many patients exhibited upon admission a strikingly intense cyanosis, especially noticeable in the lips. This was not the dusky, pallid blueness that one is accustomed to in a failing pneumonia, but rather a deep blueness. And a third, in cases with bilateral lesions, the cyanosis was marked, even to an indigo blue color. The pallor was of particularly bad prognostic import. Then, there was the blood, blood pouring from the body. To see blood trickle, and in some cases spurt from someone's nose, mouth, even from the ears or around the eyes, had to terrify. Terrifying as the bleeding was, it did not mean death. But even to physicians, even to those accustomed to thinking of the body as a machine and to trying to understand the disease process, symptoms like these previously unassociated with influenza had to be unsettling. For when the virus turned violent, blood was everywhere. Many mechanisms can cause bleeding in mucous membranes, and the precise way the influenza virus does this is unknown. Some viruses also attack platelets, which are necessary for clotting, directly or indirectly, and elements of the immune system may inadvertently attack platelets as well. In U.S. Army cantonments, from 5% to 15% of all men hospitalized suffered from epistaxis, bleeding from the nose, as with hemorrhagic viruses such as Ebola. There are many reports that blood sometimes spurted from the nose with enough power to travel several feet. Doctors had no explanation for these symptoms. They could only report them. 15% suffered from epistaxis. In about one-half the cases, a foamy, blood-stained liquid ran from the nose and mouth when the head was lowered. Epistaxis occurs in a considerable number of cases. In one person, a pint of bright red blood gushing from the nostrils. A striking feature in the early stages of these cases was a bleeding from some portion of the body. 6 cases vomited blood. 1 died from loss of blood from this cause. What was this? One of the most striking of the complications was hemorrhage from mucous membranes, especially from the nose, stomach, and intestine. Bleeding from the ears and petechial hemorrhages in the skin also occurred. One German investigator recorded hemorrhages occurring in different parts of the interior of the eye with great frequency. An American pathologist noted, 50 cases of subconjunctival hemorrhage, bleeding from the lining of the eye, were counted. 12 had a true hemoptysis, bright red blood with no admixture of mucus. 3 cases had intestinal hemorrhage. Female patients had a hemorrhagic vaginal discharge, which was at first considered to be coincident menstruation, but later was interpreted as hemorrhage from the uterine mucosa. What was this? Never did the virus cause only a single symptom. The chief diagnostician in the New York City Health Department summarized, "Cases with intense pain look and act like cases of dengue, hemorrhage from nose or bronchi. Expectoration is usually profuse and may be blood-stained. Paresis or paralysis of either cerebral or spinal origin. Impairment of motion may be severe or mild, permanent or temporary. Physical and mental depression. Intense and protracted prostration led to hysteria, melancholia, and insanity with suicidal intent." The impact on the mental state of the victims would be one of the most widely noted sequelae. During the course of the epidemic, 47% of all deaths in the United States, nearly half of all those who died from all causes combined, from cancer, from heart disease, from stroke, from tuberculosis, from accidents, from suicide, from murder, and from all other causes, resulted from influenza and its complications. And it killed enough to depress the average life expectancy in the United States by more than 10 years. Some of those who died from influenza and pneumonia would have died if no epidemic had occurred. Pneumonia was, after all, the leading cause of death. So the key figure is actually the excess death toll. Investigators today believe that in the United States, the 1918-19 epidemic caused an excess death toll of about 675,000 people. The nation then had a population between 105 and 110 million, while it was approaching 300 million in 2006. So a comparable figure today would be approximately 1,750,000 deaths. And there was something even beyond the gross numbers that gave the 1918 influenza pandemic terrifying immediacy, brought it into every home, brought it into homes with the most life. Influenza almost always selects the weakest in a society to kill, the very young and the very old. It kills opportunistically, like a bully. It almost always allows the most vigorous, the most healthy, to escape, including young adults as a group. Pneumonia was even known as the old man's friend for killing particularly the elderly, and doing so in a relatively painless and peaceful fashion that even allowed time to say goodbye. There was no such grace about influenza in 1918. It killed the young and strong. Studies worldwide all found the same thing. Young adults, the healthiest and strongest part of the population, were the most likely to die. Those with the most to live for, the robust, the fit, the hardy, the ones raising young sons and daughters, those were the ones who died. In South African cities, those between the ages of 20 and 40 accounted for 60% of the deaths. In Chicago, the deaths among those aged 20 to 40 almost quintupled deaths of those aged 41 to 60. A Swiss physician saw no severe case in anyone over 50. In the registration area of the United States, those states and cities that kept reliable statistics, breaking the population into 5-year increments, the single greatest number of deaths occurred in men and women aged 25 to 29. The second greatest number in those aged 30 to 34, the third greatest in those aged 20 to 24. And more people died in each of those 5-year groups than the total deaths among all those over age 60. Graphs that correlate mortality rates and age in influenza outbreaks always, always that is, except for 1918 to 19, start out with a peak representing infant deaths, then fall into a valley, then rise again, with a second peak representing people somewhere past 65 or so. With mortality on the vertical and age on the horizontal, a graph of the dead would look like a U. But 1918 was different. Infants did die then in large numbers, and so did the elderly. But in 1918, the great spike came in the middle. In 1918, an age graph of the dead would look like a W. It is a graph that tells a story of utter tragedy. Even at the front in France, Harvey Cushing recognized this tragedy and called the victims doubly dead in that they died so young. In the American military alone, influenza-related deaths totaled just over the number of Americans killed in combat in Vietnam. One in every 67 soldiers in the Army died of influenza and its complications, nearly all of them in a 10-week period beginning in mid-September. But influenza, of course, did not kill only men in the military. In the United States, it killed 15 times as many civilians as military. And among young adults, still another demographic stood out. Those most vulnerable of all to influenza, those most likely of the most likely to die, were pregnant women. As far back as the year 1557, observers connected influenza with miscarriage and the death of pregnant women. In 13 studies of hospitalized pregnant women during the 1918 pandemic, the death rate ranged from 23% to 71%. Of the pregnant women who survived, 26 lost the child. And these women were the most likely group to already have other children, so an unknown but enormous number of children lost their mothers. The most pregnant word in science is interesting. It suggests something new, puzzling, and potentially significant. Welch had asked Bert Volbach, the brilliant chief pathologist at the great Boston hospital known as the Brigham, to investigate the Devens cases. Volbach called it the most interesting pathological experience I have ever had. The epidemiology of this pandemic was interesting. The unusual symptoms were interesting. And the autopsies, and some symptoms revealed themselves only in autopsy, were interesting. The damage this virus caused and its epidemiology presented a deep mystery. An explanation would come, but not for decades. In the meantime, this influenza, for it was, after all, only influenza, left almost no internal organ untouched. Another distinguished pathologist noted that the brain showed marked hyperemia, blood flooding the brain, probably because of an out-of-control inflammatory response, adding, "The convolutions of the brain were flattened and the brain tissues were noticeably dry." The virus inflamed or affected the pericardium, the sac of tissue and fluid that protects the heart, and the heart muscle itself, noted others. The heart was also often relaxed and flabby, offering strong contrast to the firm, contracted left ventricle nearly always present in post-mortem in patients dying from lobar pneumonia. The amount of damage to the kidneys varied, but at least some damage occurred in nearly every case. The liver was sometimes damaged. The adrenal glands suffered necrotic areas, frank hemorrhage, and occasionally abscesses. When not involved in the hemorrhagic process, they usually showed considerable congestion. Muscles along the rib cage were torn apart both by internal toxic processes and by the external stress of coughing, and in many other muscles, pathologists noted necrosis, or waxy degeneration. Even the testes showed very striking changes, encountered in nearly every case. It was difficult to understand why such severe toxic lesions of the muscle and the testis should occur. And finally came the lungs. Physicians had seen lungs in such condition, but those lungs had not come from pneumonia patients. Only one known disease, a particularly virulent form of bubonic plague called pneumonic plague, which kills approximately 90% of its victims, ripped the lungs apart in the way this disease did. So did weapons in war. An army physician concluded, "The only comparable findings are those of pneumonic plague and those seen in acute death from toxic gas." 70 years after the pandemic, Edwin Kilbourn, a highly respected scientist who has spent much of his life studying influenza, confirmed this observation, stating that the condition of the lungs was unusual in other viral respiratory infections and is reminiscent of lesions seen following inhalation of poison gas. But the cause was not poison gas, and it was not pneumonic plague. It was only influenza. Chapter 21. In 1918 in particular, influenza struck so suddenly that many victims could remember the precise instant they knew they were sick. So suddenly that throughout the world, reports were common of people who toppled off horses, collapsed on the sidewalk. Death itself could come so fast. Charles Edward Winslow, a prominent epidemiologist and professor at Yale, noted, "We have had a number of cases where people were perfectly healthy and died within 12 hours. The Journal of the American Medical Association carried reports of death within hours. One robust person showed the first symptom at 4 p.m. and died by 10 a.m. In the plague of the Spanish Lady, the influenza pandemic of 1918 to 1919, writer Richard Collier recounted this. In Rio de Janeiro, a man asked medical student Ciro Vieira da Cunha, who was waiting for a streetcar, for information in a perfectly normal voice, then fell down dead. In Cape Town, South Africa, Charles Lewis boarded a streetcar for a 3-mile trip home when the conductor collapsed dead. In the next 3 miles, 6 people aboard the streetcar died, including the driver. Lewis stepped off the streetcar and walked home. It was the lungs that had attracted attention from pathologists first. Physicians and pathologists had many times seen lungs of those dead of pneumonia. Many of the deaths from influenza pneumonia did look like these normal pneumonias. And the later in the epidemic a victim died, the higher was the percentage of autopsy findings that resembled normal pneumonia, bacterial pneumonia. Those who died very quickly, A day or even less after the first symptoms, however, most likely died of an overwhelming and massive invasion of the virus itself. The virus destroyed enough cells in the lung to block the exchange of oxygen. This alone was unusual and puzzling. But the lungs of the men and women who died 2 days, 3 days, 4 days after the first symptom of influenza bore no resemblance to normal pneumonias at all. They were more unusual, more puzzling. In April, a Chicago pathologist had sent lung tissue samples to the head of a research institute and asked him to look over it as a new disease. British pathologists in France had commented on strange autopsy findings in the spring. Capps had mentioned unusual findings in the lungs to Welch, Cole, and other members of the inspection party in June. The lungs Welch himself had seen in the Devon's autopsy room had made him fear that the disease was a new one. The respiratory tract serves a single purpose: to transfer oxygen from the air into red blood cells. One can picture the entire system as an inverted oak tree. The trachea, the windpipe, carries air from the outside world into the lungs and is the equivalent of the tree trunk. This trunk then divides into two great branches, each called a primary bronchus, which carry oxygen into the right and left lungs. Each primary bronchus subdivides into smaller and smaller bronchi, smaller branches, as they enter the lungs until they become bronchioles. Bronchi have cartilage, which helps give the lung a kind of architectural structure. Bronchioles do not have cartilage. Each lung itself subdivides into lobes. The right lung has 3, the left only 2. The lobes subdivide into a total of 19 smaller pockets. Within these pockets, sprouting like leaves from the smaller bronchi and the bronchioles, are clusters of tiny sacs called alveoli. They are much like tiny but porous balloons, and the average person has 300 million of them. The alveoli play a role comparable to that which leaves play in photosynthesis. In the alveoli, the actual transfer of oxygen into the blood takes place. The right side of the heart pumps blood without oxygen into the lungs, where it passes into capillaries, the smallest blood vessels, so small that individual blood cells often move in single file. Capillaries surround the alveoli, and oxygen molecules slip through the membrane of the alveolar tissue and attach to the hemoglobin of the red blood cells as they circulate past them. After picking up oxygen, the blood returns to the left side of the heart, where it is pumped through arteries throughout the body. The body's entire blood supply moves through the lungs each minute. In arteries, red blood cells carry oxygen and are bright red. In veins, such as those visible on one's wrist, the same cells without oxygen are bluish. When the lungs fail to oxygenate the blood, part of the body, and in some cases the entire body, can turn blue, causing cyanosis. Lack of oxygen, if extended for any length of time, damages and ultimately kills other organs in the body. Healthy lung tissue is light, spongy, and porous, much lighter than water, and a good insulator of sound. A physician percussing the chest of a healthy patient will hear little. When normal lung tissue is manipulated, it crepitates. As the air in the alveoli escapes, it makes a crackling noise similar to rubbing hairs together. A congested lung sounds different from a healthy one. Solid tissue conducts breathing sounds to the chest wall, so someone listening can hear rowls, crackling or wheezing sounds, although it can also sound either dull or hyper-resonant. If the congestion is dense enough and widespread enough, the lung is consolidated. In bronchopneumonia, bacteria, and many kinds of bacteria can do this, invade the alveoli themselves. Immune system cells follow them there, and so do antibodies, fluid, and other proteins and enzymes. An infected alveolus becomes dense with this material, which prevents it from transferring oxygen to the blood. This consolidation appears in patches surrounding the bronchi, and the infection is usually fairly localized. In lobar pneumonia, entire lobes become consolidated and transformed into a liver-like mass. hence the word hepatization to describe it. A hepatized lobe can turn various colors depending on the stage of disease. Gray hepatization, for example, indicates that various kinds of white blood cells have poured into the lung to fight an infection. A diseased lung also includes the detritus of dissolved cells, along with various proteins such as fibrin and collagen that are part of the body's efforts to repair damage. These repair efforts can cause their own problems. Fibrosis occurs when too much fibrin interferes with the normal functioning of the lung. Roughly two-thirds of all bacterial pneumonias and an even higher percentage of lobar pneumonias are caused by a single group of bacteria, the various subtypes of the pneumococcus. The pneumococcus is also the second leading cause of meningitis. A virulent pneumococcus can spread through an entire lobe within a matter of hours. Even today, in 20 to 30% of the cases of lobar pneumonia, bacteria also spread through the blood to infect other areas of the body, and many victims still die. Some cyanosis is not unusual in lobar pneumonia, but most of the lung often still looks normal. In 1918, pathologists did see at autopsy the normal devastation of the lungs caused by the usual lobar and bronchopneumonias. But the lungs from those who died quickly during the pandemic, the lungs that so confused even Welch, those lungs were different. Said one pathologist, "Physical signs were confusing. Typical consolidation was seldom found." And another, "The old classification by distribution of the lesions was inappropriate." And another, "Essentially toxic damage to alveolar walls and exudation of blood and fluid. Very little evidence of bacterial action could be found in some of these cases." At a discussion reported in the Journal of the American Medical Association, several pathologists concurred, "The pathological picture was striking and was unlike any type of pneumonia ordinarily seen in this country. The lung lesions, complex and variable, struck one as being quite different in character to anything one had met with at all commonly in the thousands of autopsies one had performed during the last 20 years. Normally, when the lungs are removed, they collapse like deflated balloons. Not now. Now they were full, but not of air. In bacterial pneumonias, normally the infection rages inside the alveoli, inside the tiny sacs. In 1918, while the alveoli were also sometimes invaded, the spaces between the alveoli were filled. This space, which makes up the bulk of the volume of the lung, was filled with the debris of destroyed cells and with every element of the immune system, from enzymes to white blood cells. And it was filled with blood. One more observer concluded that the acute death he saw evidence of in the lungs is a lesion which does not occur in other types of pulmonary infection. In influenza, it is the lesion of characterization. Victims' lungs were being ripped apart as a result of, in effect, collateral damage from the attack of the immune system on the virus. Since the respiratory tract must allow outside air to pass into the innermost recesses of the body, it is extremely well defended. The lungs became the battleground between the invaders and the immune system. Nothing was left standing on that battleground. The immune system begins its defense far in advance of the lungs, with enzymes in saliva that destroy some pathogens, including HIV, which makes its home in most bodily fluids, but not in saliva, where enzymes kill it. Then it raises physical obstacles, such as nasal hairs that filter out large particles, and sharp turns in the throat that force inhaled air to collide with the sides of breathing passageways. Mucus lines these passageways and traps organisms and irritants. Underneath the layer of mucus lies a blanket of epithelial cells, and from their surfaces extend cilia, akin to tiny hairs which, like tiny oars, sweep upward continuously at from 1,000 to 1,500 beats a minute. This sweeping motion moves foreign organisms away from places they can lodge and launch an infection, and up to the larynx. If something does gain a foothold in the upper respiratory tract, the body first tries to flush it out with more fluid, hence the typical runny nose, and then expel it with coughs and sneezes. These defenses are as physical as raising an arm to block a punch and do no damage to the lungs. Even if the body overreacts, this usually does no serious harm, although an increased volume of mucus blocks air passages and makes breathing more difficult. In allergies, these same symptoms occur because the immune system does overreact. There are more aggressive defenses. Macrophages and natural killer cells, two kinds of white blood cells that seek and destroy all foreign invaders, unlike other elements of the immune system that only attack a specific threat, patrol the entire respiratory tract and lungs. Cells in the respiratory tract secrete enzymes that attack bacteria and some viruses, including influenza, or block them from attaching to tissue beneath the mucus. And these secretions also bring more white cells and antibacterial enzymes into a counterattack. If a virus is the invader, white blood cells also secrete interferon, which can block viral infection. All these defenses work so well that the lungs themselves, although directly exposed to outside air, are normally sterile. But when the lungs do become infected, other defenses, lethal and violent defenses, come into play. For the immune system is at its core a killing machine. It targets infecting organisms, attacks with a complex arsenal of weapons, some of them savage weapons, and neutralizes or kills the invader. The balance, however, between kill and overkill, response and overresponse, is a delicate one. The immune system can behave like a SWAT team that kills the hostage along with the hostage taker, or the army that destroys the village to save it. In 1918 especially, this question of balance played a crucial role in the war between virus and immune system, and between life and death. The virus was often so efficient at invading the lungs that the immune system had to mount a massive response to it. What was killing young adults a few days after the first symptom was not the virus. The killer was the massive immune response itself. The virus attaches itself normally to epithelial cells, which line the entire respiratory tract like insulation in a tube all the way to the alveoli. Within 15 minutes after influenza viruses invade the body, their hemagglutinin spikes begin binding with the sialic acid receptors on these cells. One after another, these spikes attach to the receptors, each one a grappling hook binding the virus tighter and tighter to the cell. Generally, about 10 hours after the virus invades a cell, the cell bursts open, releasing between 1,000 and 10,000 viruses capable of infecting other cells. At even the lowest reproduction rate, 1,000 times 1,000 times 1,000 and so on, one can easily understand how a victim could feel perfectly healthy one moment and collapse the next, just as the fifth or sixth generation of viruses matures and infects cells. Meanwhile, the virus is also attacking the immune system directly, undermining the body's ability to protect itself. The virus inhibits the release of interferon, and interferon is usually the first weapon the body employs to fight viral infection. In 1918, the ability to inhibit the immune system was so obvious that researchers, even while overwhelmed by the pandemic, noticed that influenza victims had weakened immune responses to other stimuli. They used objective tests to prove it. Even mild influenza viruses can utterly and entirely denude the upper respiratory tract of epithelial cells, leaving it bare, stripping the throat raw. The repair process begins within a few days, but takes weeks. Once an infection gains a foothold, the immune system responds initially with inflammation. The immune system can inflame at the site of an infection, causing the redness, heat, and swelling there, or it can inflame the entire body through fever or both. The actual process of inflammation involves the release by certain white blood cells of proteins called cytokines. There are many kinds of white cells. Several kinds attack invading organisms, while other helper cells manage attacks, and still others produce antibodies. There are even more kinds of cytokines. Some cytokines attack invaders directly, such as interferon, which attacks viruses. Some act as messengers carrying orders. Macrophages, for example, release GM-CSF, which stands for Granulocyte Macrophage Colony Stimulating Factor. GM-CSF stimulates the production in the bone marrow of more macrophages as well as granulocytes, another kind of white blood cell. Some cytokines also carry messages to parts of the body not normally considered belonging to the immune system. Several cytokines can affect the hypothalamus, which acts like the body's thermostat. When these cytokines bind to receptors in the hypothalamus, body temperature goes up. The entire body becomes inflamed. Fever is part of the immune response. Some pathogens do not grow well at higher temperatures. In influenza, fever routinely climbs to 103 and can go higher. But cytokines themselves also have toxic effects. The typical symptoms of influenza outside the respiratory tract, the headache and body ache, are caused not by the virus, but by cytokines. A side effect of cytokines stimulating the bone marrow to make more white cells, for instance, is likely what aches in the bone. Cytokines can cause more serious and permanent damage as well. Tumor necrosis